Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 4th, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good to have you aboard. And we're also joined by climate hawk and author, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well, thank you.
That's good. Good. Good to have you as well. So this has been, this past period has been a lot of disjointed news, but all of it sort of gives us ways to have insight into how to manage climate questions. I guess one of the places to begin is with essentially a question that has to do with whether or not a nonprofit institution should accept money from people who want to, contributors who may have political views that are not consistent with the nonprofit itself. In particular, I'm thinking that this past week there's been an example of, I believe it's the Natural History Museum in New York City, which of course is essentially a kind of a science museum, but on its board of directors or one of its large contributors is a woman named Rebecca Mercer. Now, if you've not heard of Rebecca Mercer before, I'll give you the story. We'll play 7 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, whatever it is you have. Rebecca Mercer knows Steve Bannon, who used to be at Breitbart, who knows a guy named Trump, right? And Rebecca Mercer is a billionaire, daughter of a billionaire, who is also kind of a nut. But Rebecca Mercer is a very conservative climate denier, who nevertheless gives lots of money to the Metropolitan Museum of Natural History, right? D.R., did you see anything about that? Did you pick up any of that?
Yes. That there's been an effort and a petition signed by several climate hawks, including, among others, climate scientists Michael Mann and Catherine Hyo, urging the American Museum of Natural History to have no mercy on Rebecca Mercer and to remove her from their board of directors. It's very similar to a controversy that popped up a couple of years ago when the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there was a push to have David Koch leave their board of directors, and I believe he did in fact ultimately leave. So it does raise the question of why people who aren't terribly, you know, scientifically interested, scientifically inclined, want to be involved in, you know, pro science activities, unless it's sort of an ego boosting thing or a way to sort of, you know, launder their image, basically.
There's also the Smithsonian, which there's the Hall of Human Origins, which was made possible by a $15 million grant from David Koch, and in that exhibit, it whitewashes the dangers of modern day climate change in this misleading evolution exhibit at the National Museum of Natural History. I know that was an old, I don't know if that's still there. If that exhibit is still up, I would assume. I know at least in a couple, you know, as of a couple of years ago, it was there.
Well, and
Rome was criticizing it a lot.
Koch is one of the Koch brothers is here in Boston on the NPR board, right? Right, or the National Public Radio Board or something.
He used to be on the WGBH Board of Trustees. He left, I believe, in 2016.
Okay. And of course, the Koch brothers have given a fair amount of money to MIT. So I guess, for me, the big question is, should an organization like a museum dedicated to science and the education of the public about science accept money from someone whose political stance is essentially opposite the goal of the museum? I mean, regardless of why Rebecca Mercer wants to dump money into the Museum of Natural History, right? Should the Museum of Natural History take it? Is it influenced, right? This is, you know, I'm sure the Museum of Natural History will deny being influenced by the money, but that's hard to believe, right? That you can't, that you're not going to be influenced by someone who is a big donor. Do you have a stance on that, DR?
I think there's an inherent conflict of interest. I mean, if you're an organization that is supposed to stand for science, you really can't be associated with anti-science. So I think it's a no-brainer that they should not take the money.
But, you know, like you look at something, you know, a $15 million grant to build an entire exhibit, where is, you know, where's the National Museum of Natural History going to get that money otherwise, right? I mean, you know, it's a lot of fundraising. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I agree with you, DR, I agree with you, Ted, but at the same time, like, you know, museums need money, right? They need to sustain themselves somehow. And I feel like it could be a hard place to be in when someone says, here's $15 million. You could do so much with it at your museum, but I want you to make sure that your exhibit is just a little bit misleading about climate change. You know,
but it does raise the question of why don't more, you know, progressive minded or science minded people, you know, kick in some money to these museums. You know, why doesn't Tom Steyer cut a check to that, you know, American Museum of Natural History, that sort of thing?
Well, he's certainly been doing his part in a lot of other ways, that's for sure.
But I guess for me, the question is, you know, you can ratchet back another level. You say, I mean, the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation are now great forces for good. The Carnegie, you know, Andrew Carnegie, after he broke all the unions and, you know, with the Pinkerton police in the 1870s and built U.S. Steel, right, he went around funding libraries across the United States, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, in a democracy, should a democracy rely on these big spending guys who've made it? You know, is the society better off to be relying on powerful people to donate for specific causes? Or should the money for the Natural History Museum come in smaller doses from more people? Now, of course, that's I'm sure, ideally, that's what you'd like, right? Lots of people giving $10 or something. But you're building a society that is dependent on the largesse of very wealthy people, right? And generally speaking, if you look, the Carnegie Institution, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, they are now forces for great good, even though they may have been quite destructive as they started out. I mean, I don't know. I mean, do you think there will ever be a day where the Koch Brother Foundation will be, you know, pushing green energy solutions? I mean, 100 years from now, that when these two geezers are gone, that their children try and rectify things?
Well, I think was it the MacArthur Foundation? I may be wrong. Wasn't the MacArthur Foundation that at one point funded a lot of right wing causes, and then an elder MacArthur died, and the younger person took over, started funding a bit of progressive causes. That sort of, or of course the other example of Ray Kroc, being a pretty big Republican, and then his wife was a pretty big Democrat, and then when Joan Kroc, you know, she donated a lot of money to NPR and some other organizations that she regarded as progressive, that sort of thing.
Right, and I guess it's back to even if it was Tom Steyer was going to give $1 billion to the to some organization, would that be the model you want? Right, heavy duty fund. I mean, I don't know. It's just a question. It's a way to think about the society. So,
yeah, it takes everybody stepping up and giving that $10,
right.
You know, right, to the causes you believe in, the causes you support, and understanding that if you give, it may not feel like a lot to give $20 to the museum that you want to make sure stays unbiased, but if everyone did that, it does make a difference. Yeah. They can refuse the $15 million that comes with strings.
Right. Well, there you go. So we will, I'm going to send my $10 to the Museum of Natural History, and that will fund Rebecca Mercer for about 30 seconds on her next ski trip. So you got that. I guess the other another interesting topic that came up this past week is actually a good news story. Last fall, there were several elections in which progressive forces succeeded, maybe beyond their expectations. But New Jersey was a particular place where I won't call him any pejoratives, but the governor of New Jersey moved on. Right, Chris Christie is gone, and there is now a progressive governor in New Jersey. Tell me, Dia, do you remember, or do I need to tell you what the governor of New Jersey did vis-a-vis greenhouse gas stuff?
Well, I believe they, Phil Murphy, the new governor I almost said Missouri, New Jersey, he has signed an executive order that will put New Jersey back into the regional greenhouse gas initiative. New Jersey was removed from REGI in 2011 when the current ABC commentator Chris Christie and former governor pulled the state out at the apparent behest of the Koch brothers.
But the traffic director in the ABC parking lot. And,
yes, but now Murphy is back in the game, and it will remain to be seen if this is a sort of hokey pokey type thing where if they get another denialist elected governor in a few years while they pull the state out again.
Right, but true that. But I think the fact that New Jersey and I saw somewhere potentially Virginia will try to join the regional greenhouse gas initiative is a very good thing. If you don't know what the REGGIE is, REGGIE is an acronym for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is an agreement among now, I don't know, 9 or 10 of the New England states to have a cap and trade system where they, for production of electricity, so their electricity generation plants have to trade and buy permission to pollute as they generate the electricity. And that limits the greenhouse gas emissions, and it generates cash revenue for the states that are participating. So yeah, it's a good, good thing.
The facts I said is that prior to New Jersey pulling out of REGGIE, they were receiving about $50 million a year in revenue to spend on clean energy and energy efficiency. So, you know, Murphy's saying that pulling out of the REGGIE cost New Jerseyans millions of dollars that could have been used.
And here in Massachusetts, those things are auctioned off, those permissions. So it's very abstract, right? So there's these abstract ideas, but the permission to pollute is auctioned, and you have to pay a lot of money to get that permission to pollute so you can generate the electricity. And of course, the cap part of it is that there's a limitation on how many of those permissions there are. So you have to, you pay more and more for them. And at least in Massachusetts, the revenue from the auction of those permits is then driven back into clean energy programs. So it's a virtuous cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So there you go. New Jersey's heading back into REGGIE. That's good. One of the other things that happened this past week is an annual ritual called the State of the Union. You can debate about, and just so that you know, the State of the Union is written into the Constitution that the Constitution says that the president shall from time to time inform the Congress about the State of the Union. And I think that was written because back in 1776, you know, King George, if he didn't want to go see Parliament, he would say, the heck with you, and he wouldn't talk to Parliament for 10 years, right? So they wrote into the Constitution the fact that the president has to talk to Congress once in a while. And through most of the history of the United States, the president would send a written document to the Congress, which was the State of the Union report. And it wasn't until Woodrow Wilson in 1916 or so that he decided he was going to go to Congress and make the State of the Union address, which is now frozen into our politics, a big flapdoodle every January where the president goes and reports on the State of the Union. And even when you have a so-called president or a not very effective president or maybe a treasonous president or certainly a president who's not very well educated or anything, he still is president. He gets to parade around and give a State of the Union address. So after all that vile and vitriol from me, what did our current president talk about at the State of the Union? Anything interesting?
Well, he basically boasted about reducing regulations and ending what he regarded as a war on energy, and basically, you know, trying to
beautiful clean coal, right?
Beautiful clean coal. talk about a contradiction in terms. Yeah. Just the usual sort of ranting that we've come to expect. It's amazing to think that this 12 years after Bush, of all people, George W. Bush, at the 2006 State of the Union address, said that America was addicted to oil. Now we have somebody who's continuing to fuel that addiction.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, the current president, you know, is on the way to the he's on the way to the big house. I read somewhere. Did you read Charlie Pierce in Esquire? Mm-hmm. Very funny. He said that his dream was that Robert Mueller would walk into the Congress with flanked by federal marshals and arrest Trump on the way out for treason. Forget about Trump's State of the Union because it was not very relevant to our discussion. What's more interesting is that a Massachusetts congressman was asked to give the State of the Union reply or rebuttal or whatever they call it, which again is now a made-for-TV event. But Joe Kennedy III spoke in a high school down in Fall River, Massachusetts, not too far from where we are now. Tell me, DR, I'm going to call you JR, DR, what was the tone and substance of the Joe Kennedy III speech?
Well, Kennedy did mention briefly Trump's quote all-out war on environmental protection unquote, but he didn't. But he otherwise avoided any sort of real mention of the climate crisis. He did discuss, you know, Americans quote wading through floodwaters, battling hurricanes, and braving wildfires and mudslides unquote. But he didn't really, you know, emphasize the malevolence of people like Scott Pruitt and Ryan Zinke, and for the most part seemed to completely downplay the issue, which raised a lot of eyebrows. There was one article in Huffington Post basically saying that, you know, in terms of Democratic criticism of Trump's speech, the only person who really hammered away at the fact that Trump was an outlaw on climate was Bernie Sanders. It just seemed to be very, very unusual that this sort of glaring aspect of Trump's behavior, you know, the machinations of Pruitt went uncriticized by some of his political critics.
I mean, I agree with you. I think that you would think that there could be a stronger case made for climate. But I guess the question is, you know, if Joe Kennedy doesn't mention it, what does that say about the politics of discussing climate change? It's clearly not viewed by these polls as a winner, as something that attracts support. I mean,
I speculate that that's an accurate viewpoint on their part, right? I mean, I think we've talked before about how climate issues do not drive people to vote. It's not something that, you know, people are like, oh, I feel strongly about climate issues, I'm going to go out and vote necessarily. I forget where we got that information, but that won't change unless unless people start saying, okay, my feelings on climate change are important and need to be heard. And if I don't vote, then they won't be heard, kind of thing, right? You have to value your own personal vote and feeling and sort of position on climate change as key.
Well, tell me, so would the Democratic, so here's a question. Would the Democratic Party benefit from a strident wing of the party, let's call them climate hawks, that tried to primary even reasonable Democrats? I mean, it seems like the Republican Party has primaried every moderate Republican out of the, you know, they get some crazy guy and everyone's afraid he's going to be attacked from his right on that side. But what if the Democrats were worried about being attacked from the left? Because I agree with you. I mean, Joe Kennedy's not going to talk about climate until he's forced to, right? Mm-hmm. But everyone, I guess myself included, starts to say, well, at least he's better than the jerks on the other side. So let's, you know, do you make the perfect the enemy of the good, right? Should we be having a more strident attack and forcing the politicians to confront the issues?
I mean, I think it's a lot of it's framing, right? I mean, for so long, environmental issues were framed as, you know, save the trees and save the polar bears, and in such a way that just it doesn't resonate with people who that's just so far from their everyday reality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger talked about how they stopped saying that in California and started saying, this is for public health. This is for, you know, reducing the incidences of asthma, reducing the medical costs that are being incurred from being exposed to the emissions of fossil fuels or the you know, water that's contaminated, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And when they started framing it in that light, it did become an issue that was more widely regarded as key for voting because, you know,
it's self-interest. You're
concerned. Yeah. You're concerned when your children are, you know, have asthma and it's because there's a power plant factory that's nearby. I mean, that gets you up to vote.
Well, it's an interesting case because I agree with you that talking about polar bears and trees doesn't get anyone moving, right?
Except for people like us, like right? I care about polar bears, right? I mean, mm-hmm. but right, it doesn't. It, you know, but it has a wide array.
Is talking. So I've heard an argument that says talking about climate change in terms of values, all right, responsibility to the future, prudence, you know, basically conservatism, you know, that this is the right responsible adult way to treat the future. it's not clear to me that works. But to your point, what you're saying, Roy, is, you know, forget about the third party harm to the polar bears. Talk about the first party harm to you as an individual, and that gets people's attention. And so the climate stuff needs to be reframed as a threat to your family in the here and now. And that's where you get people out talking to Joe Kennedy about climate change.
Yeah, I mean, so there's that. I mean, so what you're saying about the sort of the threat to the future, I think that's people say that's kind of like a retirement plan, right? People don't put money into a retirement plan because it's so far away that it's hard to sort of get energized about that when you have immediate places for your money. And I think in the same sense, climate change is, if you say it's, well, you know, this is going to affect future generations, that doesn't make it an immediate concern that would drive people to the vote. So I think you're right about the, you know, future generations is not a motivator.
Values are not a motivator. It's value, immediate
right,
harm.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I also, you know, just to kind of, so yes, I think sort of really understanding that the impact of, you know, what is it? 8 million people die worldwide prematurely from air pollution globally. So yes, I think that certainly is something to be concerned about. But then I also go back a lot to the importance of the opportunities that are presented by renewable energy, mm-hmm. and how fear can be a short-term motivator, but it's not a good long-term motivator. And climate change is a long-term problem that we're going to need long-term motivation for. And when you look at all of the opportunity available from switching to renewable energy, you know, the financial savings, the air quality savings, the jobs, you know, that the new infrastructure that we would need for it would create, I also think opportunity is another good place, and I don't have a lot of information to back that up with. But
well, I mean, this harkens back to the article we talked about a few weeks ago of how nobody really knows how to talk about climate. Because if you talk, we had the article in New York Magazine that was, you know, horrifying future, right? The fear aspect versus the opportunity aspect versus the responsibility aspect. And I guess the bottom line is you have to talk about it in 10 different ways. But I still like to get Joe Kennedy's attention, have him be a little more worried about climate.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, two words, Zephyr Teachout. Remember that primary she launched 4 years ago against then-Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, who's still the governor, and sort of pressed him on this issue and is widely credited as basically motivating Cuomo to ban fracking in New York State.
Huh. All right. So, let me ask this question. We're running out of, we're at 22 minutes, so anybody who's still listening, I guess, do you think that it's worthwhile as a climate hawk, could you mount a campaign based solely on energy, climate issues? Right? Is it credible, or are you just a one-dimensional candidate that tries to attract voters, or would you build sort of a coherent philosophy of governing around sort of a climate-related clean energy kind of platform? Is that plausible?
I feel like if you find the right tune, right, the right tune to play on the radio, if you, you know, really can find all of the talking points that pull people in from an economic standpoint, from a health standpoint, yeah, but you need to do that spin and that framing. I hate to call it spin and framing, that's what it is in some degree that makes it a hot topic and something that pulls everyone in. I don't know how to do that, but that's what you need.
I think. Maybe we'll open up the Climate Minute Political Consulting Agency. Anyway, we got to put it down there. We've run out of time. What did Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers on NPR say? There you've gone, wasted another perfectly good hour listening to the car talk. All right, so what we'll do is we'll put up links to some of what we talked about on the blog. The blog's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook at @massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on various kinds of podcast distribution services now, including Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, SoundCloud, Podbean, of course, iTunes. On any and all of those, please rate us. Please subscribe to us. Please tell your friends about us. Please send us a note about the things you'd like to hear us talk about. Please send us a note about the stuff you want us to stop talking about. I'm sure there's a few of those. Anyway, we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, Mariah.
Thank you.
DR, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to all you guys for listening. We really love having you along. Take care. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.